from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The first show we did on Ebola, the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, was in April. The numbers of dead seemed big then, but look tiny now as the death toll has climbed over 2,000. West African nations have failed to contain Ebola. So has the international community. Now the U.S. military is taking a role. There's talk of ramping up, but Ebola is ramping up faster. This hour on Point, we go to the front lines and ask how we stop Ebola now that thousands of people have already died and thousands more are infected. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Who should take charge of the effort to stop Ebola? Do you worry that it's become almost impossible to contain the deadly virus? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll talk in a moment with the Director of Operations for Doctors Without Borders, which has been in the thick of the Ebola outbreak and begging for more help for months. And later this hour, we'll look at a respiratory virus hitting children in at least a dozen states in the United States, Kansas City, Chicago particularly hard hit. But first, to Africa. Joining me now from Accra in Ghana is Drew Henshaw. He covers West Africa for the Wall Street Journal and was in Monrovia, Liberia, until Friday. There in Monrovia, where Ebola is hitting very hard. Drew Henshaw, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The scenes that you're painting from the streets of Monrovia are absolutely heartbreaking and terrifying. People dying of Ebola in the backs of ambulances, in the backs of taxis, going all over the city and beyond looking for somewhere for treatment, and there is nowhere for them.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's really scary. As a journalist, you're used to showing up in these countries where there's crises happening, and usually it takes a little bit of work to find, you know, you show up to a place where a bomb has gone off, and it takes a little bit of work to find a bomb victim or something like that. What really scares me in Liberia is how easy it is to find someone who's looking for a hospital bed right now, or to find someone whose, you know, relative has died in their house. The World Health Organization says about 4,000 people have caught Ebola, but the rough truth of this is nobody knows, and it's just really scary to stand in front of an Ebola ward and just watch taxis, ambulances, you know, private cars. There's been stories of people with wheelbarrows showing up to these clinics, and there's just not a bed, and there's a lot of people who need one.
Taxis with people dying in the back seats that will eventually take them just back home or drop them off to die, and then go out and pick up somebody else who could pick it Ebola up from sweat on the upholstery. You write.
Sure, that is a scenario. The far likelier scenario is that the taxi driver himself will get it while loading the sick into the car, or that the classic thing with Ebola is it spreads from person to person, right? From family member to family member. So what happens is when you've got a sick person with Ebola and you can't get that person into a hospital bed, they're dying at home, or if they're lucky, surviving at home. But in the meantime, who's cleaning them up? Who's taking care of them? Who's feeding them? Who's bringing them water? It's a family member, usually several family members. And then it spreads to those two or three or sometimes four or five people. And the disease, you know, is just caused five new cases in the time that it's taken healthcare workers to, you know, free up a single hospital bed.
We've got five West African nations now with Ebola. Where is it out of control? Where is it still containable within those countries?
So right now, what you've got are a few situations. Liberia is absolutely bad for the reasons we just talked about. Sierra Leone is quite similar. Guinea's a little bit under control in large measure because people in Guinea often go to Sierra Leone and Liberia for help and for healthcare and that kind of thing. Senegal has its first case. We're still waiting to find out how many people that this guy who brought it to Senegal might have exposed. The real suspense right now is in Nigeria, in the Niger Delta. Sort of a swampy area of southern Nigeria. Nigeria had it completely under control. They were doing a textbook job of finding people and bringing them in and telling people who've been exposed to Ebola, saying, hey, there was a guy who came here with Ebola. You know, you might have been exposed to him. We need you to come in, you know, and get your temperature taken a few times a day. What happened was a guy ran away. He disobeyed doctor's orders and ran away. And in doing that, he spread Ebola to an entirely new city that doesn't have the same kind of healthcare systems as other Nigerian cities. And Yeah, the suspense is really on Nigeria right now. They've done a great job until now, but now it's suspenseful.
Of course, Nigeria, the big one. I mean, enormous population, right. Enormous population all over Africa, and who knows where this will go. And we've seen that issue. People unhappy with the treatment, trying to get away. Here's a video posted earlier this week of a young man in Monrovia, Liberia, who's talking about a patient at an Ebola clinic walking away, kind of running away from the clinic, brought back by medical workers from Doctors Without Borders.
I want to get a black woman down. We come from the beginning, we know what we're Ebola champion. Today, make a fat Ebola patient come to us and all the time from the quality.
And talk about chaos. This is in the city of Monrovia. He's saying, we told the Liberian government from the beginning we don't want an Ebola camp, he calls it here. He says, today marks the fifth Ebola patient coming out of that treatment facility and vomiting and toileting. And then the crowd there shouts as a team of the guys in the protective suits come out, catch the man, kind of chase him down, catch him, and push him into the back of a truck to be brought back to the clinic. And you can hear just how bad this sounds. Drew Henshaw there in Accra, Ghana, please stand by. I want to go to Brussels right now in Brice de Lavagna. He's director of operations at Doctors Without Borders. He's overseeing the group's Ebola response. He's traveled extensively in West Africa to be on top of this. Brice de Lavagna, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi.
Your group has taken a central role in the response so far. In April, when we first talked about this, you were begging for more help. What do you make of the world's response so far to the Ebola outbreak, sir?
To say the least, we are very, very shocked by the lack of response overall, and being from many aspects, from the United Nations, but definitely as well from different nations. You may know that like last Tuesday, we called on to the UN and to the member states to have much more help and also to ask for more civil protection means as well as military logistic and medical means. But still, we are feeling very much alone. I mean, the situation you just described in Monrovia, I was in Monrovia 3 weeks ago, and really our team are facing a terrible situation. We are basically the only one with isolation and treatment center in the city, which we have today about 200 beds. And we made the calculation together with a CDC and WHO, the World Health Organization, that we need at least 1,000 beds. And we are crying, really, to have those beds because, really, the situation requires to have those beds now and not to wait a few weeks. But still, the response has been very, very little if you compare with other catastrophes like earthquake or typhoon or any kind of natural catastrophe. The response has been very, very weak.
We have heard that the spread of Ebola has gone from a kind of straight line spread, Mr. De Lavagna, to an exponential spread now. Is your staff witnessing that on the ground?
Now, if you look at the epidemiological trend the last few weeks, it has doubled almost every week. Yes, it is exponentially for the time being. And obviously, it's very difficult to know what will be the patterns and what will be the trend in a city is completely different from the countryside or outside of a big city. In a big city, I mean, the contamination can be obviously much higher. As you just explained, I mean, the two groups that are particularly targeted are the loved one, the family members who are taking care of the sick one because they cannot seek for care around them, and also the health workers who are working in the clinic. And the other catastrophe, inside the catastrophe actually in Monrovia, is you have most of the hospitals and clinics are closed as we speak because the staff is too afraid and they don't want to come to work, which you can totally understand. And meaning that anyone having a car crash or malaria or anything cannot find any hospital. We witness a pregnant woman who cannot find any facilities to deliver their babies, and their babies are dying. I mean, really, the situation is really horrific, we can say now, especially in Monrovia. But, of course, Sierra Leone is, for us, the next, definitely also.
Doctors Without Borders has historically opposed the deployment of military to deal with this kind of crisis. But this time you're welcoming news that the U.S. military is going to come in, maybe the U.K. military. Why are you open to military now?
I'm very happy you asked this question, actually. because I really want to make to explain to the auditors what is the difference. We don't restrict ourselves to call for military means when you have a natural catastrophe. It's completely different than the conflict, like you have in Afghanistan or in Syria and so on. Here, in natural catastrophe, like the one we had in the Philippines, the one we had a few years back with the tsunami, for instance, obviously military have the best means to deploy and to go rapidly to help the population. And here we are not facing a conflict where you have different parties and you can have a lot of political at stake and where humanitarian help can be used by one side to the other. Here is different. Here is an epidemic, it's medical, we need a huge logistic, and we need the help of the countries who does have this military apparatus.
So far, the United States not talking about huge logistics, talking about putting in 25 beds or something like that. I mean, nothing like the scale you're talking about in Liberia and beyond, though the scale of this challenge ramping up quickly. Michael Gerson, writing in the Washington Post, in the last 24 hours, saying we are about to witness a human catastrophe that could destroy large portions of a continent and pose a global threat. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Ebola crisis now in Africa, threatening to really damage the continent and maybe the world. We have Brice de la Vigne with us. He's director of operations at Doctors Without Borders. They have been in here just as heavily as they can be from very early on, but it's been a lonely role without a lot of international support. He joins us today from Brussels. Drew Hinshaw is with us from Accra, capital of Ghana. Covers West Africa for the Wall Street Journal, just out of Monrovia in Liberia, where the spread is really taking off these days. Here's President Obama on Meet the Press, NBC's on Sunday, saying the U.S. has to make Ebola a national security priority, getting resources and security to international public health workers. Here's the president.
If we don't make that effort now, and this spreads not just through Africa, but other parts of the world, there's the prospect then that the virus mutates, it becomes more easily transmittable, and then it could be a serious danger to the United States.
But, of course, Africa in the thick of it right now, and commercial flights being shut down, trade being affected at this point. People are worried about the African economy as fear spreads. Drew Hinshaw, we heard the head of the World Health Organization talking last week with NPR's David Green. This is the director general there, Margaret Chan, and she seemed to be saying, look, it's their problem. Here she is.
Diseases happened in people, okay? If every time a country has an outbreak, outside people begin to take over, I don't think this is the kind of situation we want to get ourselves into. We respect country leadership, national country leadership. They need to do their part, and we can do our part to help them.
The director general there of the World Health Organization, Drew Hinshaw, you know, doesn't that sound like it's their problem? Hasn't it been obvious for some time that they by no means had the means to stop this?
I'm kind of surprised to hear that. I mean, yes, I understand the principle there, but when you're talking about Liberia and Sierra Leone, you're talking about countries that don't have the tools to deal with almost any problem. These are two countries that fought one of the worst civil wars of the latter half of the 20th century. I mean, Liberia had the second lowest number of doctors per people on a World Health Organization ranking. So while I understand the principle there, I think that is sort of a principle in humanitarian aid is, you know, let's help countries help themselves. You're talking about two countries that can't even begin to fight, that are racked with epidemics all the time. I mean, you know, these countries have had cholera epidemics, typhoid problems. So Ebola, on some level, is like the latest in a long series of things. I mean, we've known for a long time that Liberia and Sierra Leone don't have the doctors and the public health care institutions to deal with this.
Brice de la Vigne with Doctors Without Borders. Michael Gerson in the Washington Post is writing that this could destroy large portions of a continent. He means Africa. Do you see that scale of threat still evolving here, sir?
Just to be clear, this is an entirely new situation. No one has faced this kind of crisis before. Then it's very difficult to say in the impracticability of the situation is one of the big problems we are facing. Yes, it's possible. Yes, when you have a multiplication of number of cases and the patient, more and more patients are getting sick, and you have no way to control, and you have today three countries that are literally where you have an epidemic not under control, out of control. No one can say today what will be, how will be the future, of course. But maybe to also to explain that measures that need to be taken are possible. It's not that complicated because, thank you, the way of transmission is very difficult. Then it is quite simple to do, but it requires a lot of logistical means and also leadership and a certain deployment, which those countries have, you just explained, it's not possible for those countries to do so, basically.
I mean, people now saying this needs to go to the UN Security Council, maybe UN peacekeeping troops to come in here, threat to a continent. The President of the United States says, ultimately, if this mutates, if this travels, a threat to the United States and beyond as well. Breach de Lavagna, standby in Brussels. Drew Hinshaw in Accra in Ghana, West Africa. With us right now from Maryland is Lawrence Gostin. He is professor of global health law at Georgetown Law School, faculty director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law. He's director of the WHO's Collaborating Center on Public Health Law and Human Rights. Lawrence Gostin, thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
We're trying to get our heads around the scale of what of the problem that has evolved here. You have called this now, this Ebola outbreak, a global security disaster. What do you mean?
Well, very much along the lines you've been talking about. I mean, I think, first of all, you've got an unprecedented health crisis. You've got an epidemic that's contagious, and it's spreading, and it's out of control. At the moment, the rise in cases is exponential, which is, you know, going straight up, and we don't know where it's going to end. You also have a humanitarian crisis because there are food security issues, employment, trade, commerce, and you've got security issues. You've got very fragile states, large distrust in government. I really do believe that the Security Council of the United Nations should mobilize a large international force, and I think it's really necessary for us to bring this epidemic under control, or else it could envelop a region, and that would it saddens me because this is the kind of epidemic that could have been prevented, we should have acted earlier, but we haven't.
I mean, we've heard many times about when the numbers are small, you simply isolate whoever's got the Ebola, you kind of put a lid on it, and it burns itself out right there. But once it's in significant populations and in urban populations, how do you do it? The WHO is saying maybe 20,000 infections by year end. Other models we're reading here say more like a 100,000. Where's the ceiling on this, Lawrence Gostin?
Well, actually, there isn't a ceiling, and that's the problem. That's the unknown. And that's what separates this from, say, an ordinary humanitarian disaster, where you have an earthquake or a tsunami. There, you have a catastrophic event, and then you have a lot of collective action to try to provide assistance and get out of it. But when it's ongoing and you don't know where it's going to end and it's multiplying, that's exactly the kind of situation where you need to have an international response. It is essential for the WHO to be very clearly involved and be in the leadership. Their constitution calls them the leading and coordinating organization for global health in the world.
But why was Margaret Chan on NPR sounding just last week like, look, they've got to take care of it. If we step in every time they've got a problem, you know, they're never going to deal with their own issues. Those countries need to deal with it.
Well, I mean, as your guests have said, the principle is that the primary responsibility for the health of any population is the government of that population. There's no question about it. But these are governments that are very fragile. Their health systems are in tatters. They were fragile to begin with, and now with already low numbers of doctors and nurses, horribly low numbers, they've now lost many to the epidemic by death and infection. Some don't turn up for work. Some are underpaid. This is the classic case for an international response. And in fact, the WHO's own international health regulations require it by international law. They require the WHO, the international community, and the countries themselves all to collaborate to bring these global epidemics under control. And in fact, Dr. Chan herself, and I'm a great admirer of Dr. Chan, declared this a global health emergency of international concern. So that was the statement of the WHO under international law, and that should have mobilized a huge international response. And I'm very troubled and, in fact, upset that it hasn't happened and we have all of this suffering going on.
Let's go to our listeners, Carol in Austin, Texas. Carol, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I was just wondering, how are you sending our UN peacekeepers to a country, an entire continent, for two countries? Can this continent not take care of itself? I mean, American soldiers, are we just going there to kill our, are we trying to kill our kids? I was a soldier for 9 years. What are our soldiers going to do here? Do they not have military to keep peace there? Do they not have a government, at least in one of the countries in the entire continent?
So you're reluctant to see U.S. soldiers, maybe even U.N. soldiers sent in?
Even U.N. soldiers. I mean, this is an entire continent that has doctors and has governments and can help, and it has the, can help itself.
Yeah.
But we're sending our kids who have plenty, enough to deal with already. How many conflicts do we have out there that are military in nature as opposed to biological in nature?
Yeah, Carol, let us pick it up. I hear the concern. Drew Hinshaw, can I put that to you first? What exactly is the U.S. military going to do? It seems like a pretty small, at this point, operation that they're describing. What is it?
Sure. I mean, frankly, there's only a few militaries or institutions in the world that have the capacity to respond to a logistical crisis like this. I mean, just to put this in perspective, Ebola is created a huge humanitarian crisis. You've got an entire country's hospitals closed down. You've got a huge economic disruption. You've got huge malnutrition because food prices have skyrocketed. You've got to set up hospitals. I mean, these things are not easy to run. You need, you know, hundreds of, like, complete head-to-toe body suits a day.
But the U.S. military is not being tasked to fix all those problems. They're going to put up 25 beds somewhere.
Right, but to set up those – right, well, that's a different point. Basically, what the reason that the Doctors Without Borders has asked these kind of institutions to come in as I understand it, is because there's not that many institutions that have the capacity to set up a hospital like that. Most of the aid groups that are doing that kind of work are stretched. The NGO community has reached the limit. As to why Africa hasn't responded, I mean, it's a complex question. And one thing I would just say is, you know, this is a big, big, big continent. Most of this continent is not dealing with Ebola. Most of this continent, yep, which is very far from Liberia and Sierra Leone — Sierra Leone is closer to London than it is to Kenya — most of this continent is detached from this problem.
But Nairobi has stopped commercial flights because of fear of it.
Yeah. Right, right.
Lawrence, I hear you there.
Yes, I wanted to come in here because I do think that there is a role for an international force. And we sit, and the United Nations sends international peacekeeping forces into hotspots around the world, and including for humanitarian reasons. And many of these international forces include African troops, and I think in this case they ought to, because it's on their home ground. It's greater legitimacy.
But what about our listener who says, what are you doing sending American soldiers there? You know, she's a 9-year military veteran, and it looks to her like it could be a death sentence for them.
Well, let me explain that. First of all, when you send soldiers into any kind of a dangerous zone, including an infectious disease zone, you take every precaution to protect them. And I have no doubt that we would make absolutely certain that our forces, British forces, are in there as well, are being kept safe. And what they would do is they wouldn't be involved in an aggressive military role. They would be helping secure clinics and health workers and make sure that things were orderly. But they would also have the logistical capacity to bring supplies in of infection control equipment, to build isolation units, to build temporary shelters or hospitals or clinics. and to really just try to provide that kind of huge logistical support that these countries need. I mean, we are Americans, and the way I think of ourselves is we are a country that thinks of ourselves as humanitarian and deeply concerned. How are we going to live with ourselves knowing that this was a horrible tragedy and we did nothing? We must do something, and we are the most powerful country in the world. President Obama said it was a security threat, and I do think that we should be among those who take the lead, but it does need to be an international response, not just the United States.
Joe in New Orleans. Thank you for calling, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just going to tell you that one of my best friends, a former tenant of mine here in New Orleans, is one of the world's leading authorities on hemorrhagic fevers. I met him as a tenant who was at Tulane Medical School getting his PhD.
Yeah.
My wife and I have been texting him regularly in Sierra Leone, and the thing that's really perplexing is that they've got healthcare workers who are getting sick, even though as best they can track, they haven't violated any protocol as far as containment goes. And so they're not really sure how these people are getting sick.
He's working on fighting Ebola in Sierra Leone, you say?
That is correct.
Joe, let us pick it up before the break. If I may, I'll take it to our Doctors Without Borders Director of Operations, Brice de Levagne, in Brussels. What's the experience of your health workers in Africa, Brice? Are they staying healthy if they follow protocol for safety?
Yes, and it has to be very strict. I mean, this is our very first objective is, of course, to be able to respond to the epidemic, but definitely also the safety of our staff is very our main concern all the time, really. Then we have very strict protocols, and we have set up a very high safety measures, much higher than it should be required for the type of virus, actually. And so far, it has helped us a lot. I mean, we have sent hundreds of staff in West Africa, and so far we have been successful in protecting our staff the best way we could. But of course, and that's why also partly also we require also the help of the military, because we think that you need this very strong discipline also to be able to provide the safety to the staff.
It's hard to picture what it's going to take at this point to lock this down. Drew Hinshaw, do you see the beginnings of an adequate response?
I think you see the beginnings of what an adequate response would look like. I mean, to go to the Doctors Without Borders clinic in Monrovia, you see it and you say, oh, this is how it's supposed to work. When someone gets sick, they come here, they're taken care of here, they don't infect other people. The problem is that it's just not enough. There's just not enough beds. You need a multiple of what's already there. I mean, you know, the world has been fighting this virus since 1970, since the late 70s.
But never on this scale. On this scale.
That's exactly my point. We know what to do. It's just how to get it to the scale we need is the tough question, especially since we don't even know how many cases are out there.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about the Ebola crisis now in Africa, threatening to really damage the continent and maybe the world. A little later in this hour, we'll look at the respiratory virus now affecting children in the United States. It's quickly spreading now in a dozen states, pretty severe symptoms, but of course nothing like Ebola, which kills half, nearly, of those that it touches. Drew Hinshaw is with us with the Wall Street Journal from Ghana in West Africa. Brice de Levagne, Director of Operations for Doctors Without Borders, which has been at the heart of the effort to stop this, but has not had the scale to do it. Lawrence Gostin is with us. He is Director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law at Georgetown University. I'm just reading here that another plane is now headed for the U.S. with a fourth American aid worker sickened with Ebola. It's actually landed in Metro Atlanta now. Two, of course, already have come to Atlanta. A third has gone to Omaha. Now a fourth in Atlanta. This just keeps going. Lawrence Gostin, can you describe the scale of the response that it will now take to put a lid on this, to stop this?
Well, I do think it's going to take an order of magnitude more than we're doing now. I think we're beginning to mobilize. The WHO put out a roadmap. It's seeking funding. The World Bank has offered assistance, many other international organizations. But still, on the ground, the response is futile. So what we need is to be able to have state-of-the-art infection control, isolation. We need competent public health workers that can do.
But we just seem like appallingly far from that. It's hard to even imagine when you see the scenes there. Of how does that show up? As if, you know, beamed down from a spaceship. How does that happen? Who's in charge?
Well, that's the big question. I don't think anybody's in charge at the moment. I mean, you have 100 sergeants in a very fragmented, uncoordinated response. I think the WHO should be in charge. That's their constitutional mission. But I think that they simply don't have the capacity to do that, and they've turned into a technical agency more than a mobilized force to respond to epidemics, and their budget has been cut. And so I think it's, you know.
So who's it going to be? I mean, this isn't.
Well, I think, you know, I'm calling for two things. One is a United Nations Security Council to mobilize a response, much in the way that Doctors Without Borders and others have been asking for this kind of mobilization. And I'd also like to see an international health systems fund, a contingency fund. The World Health Organization's own independent commission in 2011 recommended this standards, standing surge capacity, where you could actually mobilize experienced workers and resources quickly.
May I ask you, and forgive me, but our time is so short, how far could this spread if we don't do this full-on response? How much of Africa could it hit, and could it move beyond? The president said the virus could mutate, could become more easily transmittable, could become a serious danger to the United States. What about for the rest of Africa and the rest of the world? What's the threat here?
Well, I mean, I think if it's Ebola as we know it, there are certain hemorrhagic fevers in primates, not in humans, that have mutated to in a respiratory way. It would take a significant mutation for that to happen. I don't think we're anticipating, but we need to plan for it in case it does. If that were to happen, then all bets are off, and this would be a huge international global crisis. But for now, I think it threatens the region first and foremost, and that's enough. But also, it's in international capitals. Flights will take off. I think poorer countries will be worst off if it really did get a foothold in a place like Lagos or Johannesburg. It would be disastrous. But for now, I think Western Europe, the United States, are relatively safe. We have the capacity to be able to contain this very, very readily. That would be different if it mutated, but that's not something I'm anticipating, but something we need to plan for.
Bristi Lavagna with Doctors Without Borders. Your group has done heroic work and continues to. What do you see as necessary now to stop this, the spread of Ebola in Africa?
I mean, just to complete a bit the analysis, I mean, the bottom line is any country with a weak health system is at threat, basically. And that's why if you have a combination of a movement of population with weak health system, then it can spread out very easily. Now, what it takes, and what we have been repeating endlessly, is basically we need to isolate the sick ones. We need to isolate them as much as possible. We need to provide this care, and we need those isolation centers. That's why we continue to repeat that.
But who has the scale of logistical capacity to perform that and lead that at this point?
But if you think, actually, our analysis on that one, but we are not the expert on what you call NBC, nuclear, bacteriological, and chemical warfare, that many armies have been trained on, especially during the Cold War and so on. And we are expecting those armies to have, of course, this is not entirely can be applicable to Ebola, but they have already the means, the protocols, and they could be adapted and then be deployed rapidly.
To break out the chemical warfare suits and equipment and plans.
Yeah, and to be honest, I mean, this is almost our only hope. There is not much else that can be done. I mean, we need that capacity, and there is no solution in Africa or elsewhere other than those countries that does have this capacity, basically.
Drew Hinshaw, it's kind of incredible. Our only hope for major military powers to break out their chemical or biological warfare capacity and deploy it in Liberia, in Sierra Leone.
Right.
Can you see that happening, Drew?
I think that's absolutely correct. Just to put this in perspective, you know, if people feel like Africa is not pulling its weight here, the Democratic Republic of Congo sent its top Ebola expert to Liberia. A few weeks after he got there, the Congo had its own unrelated outbreak of Ebola. So right now, Congo's dealing with an outbreak, and it's got its top expert in Liberia. Uganda, you walk around like Monrovia these days, and you meet a lot of Ugandan public health officials. These guys have dealt with 4 Ebola outbreaks back home in Uganda. Now they're all in Liberia, and you know, hoping that it doesn't catch a flight to Uganda or something. So I think that's absolutely correct. You know, there's not a lot of public health expertise. It's a legacy of the brain drain. There's a lot of Nigerian doctors in the U.S. and England, not enough in Nigeria.
If this continues at an exponential rate of increase, could you see Africa continuing to kind of seize up, flights shutting down, commerce shutting down?
Unfortunately, I can. And, you know, that's really unfortunate because this is a huge continent. It's a bit like canceling flights to China because something's happening in Syria. I mean, this is a huge continent. Most places in the continent are not going to be touched by this. You've had like a lot of tourists are canceling trips to Kenya and South Africa, which is just sort of irrational because of Ebola fears. I mean, it's really unfortunate because Africa was starting to get a little bit of interest from abroad as a place where, you know, 99% of Africans are not close to Ebola. They're not, mm-hmm. you know, living in these disease kind of conditions that this stereotype might suggest. And this was really kind of, Africa's had a lot of good news out of Africa the past few years. And this has sort of interrupted it. Barack Obama had a big summit for African leaders
a few
weeks
ago. Sure, we all watched it. Well, let's hope we can figure out a way to put a lid on this and keep that 99% free of it and the rest of the world as well. But right now, it is hard to see the mechanism in place to get that done. Only hope, says Brice de Lavagne at Doctors Without Borders, bring in chemical biological warfare capacity from the rest of the world. Mr. de Lavagne, our thanks to your group, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, for all the work you've done and for joining us this hour. Thank you very much. Good luck.
Thank you.
Lawrence Gustin at Georgetown Law School and the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Drew Hinshaw with the Wall Street Journal, who's done so much reporting right out of the thick of this. Thanks for your reporting, Drew, and thanks for joining
us
today.
Thanks so much.
In a moment, a bad respiratory virus affecting children in at least a dozen states in the United States. This is On Point. At least a dozen states have contacted the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention about suspected clusters of children in America with a severe respiratory virus. The virus, Enterovirus 68, mimics a very bad cold, causing fever and coughing. No one's yet died from the virus, but many, especially children with asthma, have had to be treated in intensive care units. With me now from Nashville, Tennessee, is William Schaffner, professor and chairman of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, also professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases. Dr. Schaffner, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Good to be with you. It's always on an occasion like this.
Yes, I'm sorry for that, but then that's your business and expertise, sir. We have heard a lot in the last 24 hours about these outbreaks. Kansas City with a pretty intense outbreak, Chicago, and then a lot of other places as well. Kids in intensive care in really scary condition. What is this Enterovirus 68?
So it Enterovirus 68 is a member of a family of enteroviruses. There are over 100 of them, but it's a bit of a rogue. It's pretty rare. We've never had an outbreak this large before. And rather than being an enterovirus that is in the intestinal tract, this one behaves more like a respiratory virus. And so it's transmitted very readily among children, back to school. The kids are all together. Big transmission. The illness starts with fever, and then you get coughing and sneezing. Lots of children infected. A few of them have trouble breathing. It may precipitate an asthma attack, and that's what's bringing them to the hospital. The good news is this is not a fatal infection. It will come. It will go. They'll recover. Next week, they'll be back in school. But thank goodness.
That's great. But in Kansas City, for example, just in August, they had 300 kids with this, and 15% of them, which seems pretty high, ended up in intensive care. What are the symptoms that required that level of care?
It's difficulty breathing or the precipitation of an asthma attack, such that, you know, asthma makes it difficult for people to get their air in and out. And this virus does more of this energizing, if you will, the respiratory tract, and that leads to difficulty breathing. We can take those children, bring them in, give them oxygen. Some of them have to be put on a ventilator, but the viral infection will run its course, rarely, very rarely, associated with a complication like pneumonia, and the children come out the other end as good as they went in.
If it's been in Kansas City and Chicago and now a dozen other American cities reporting, does that mean in this winter season it will eventually be everywhere in this country?
Well, now my crystal ball, cloudy, says that enteroviruses are transmitted in the end of August, during September, and into October, and then they wane. But this one is odd, so I can't quite predict what we're going to see with this one. As I say, we've never had an outbreak this extensive. It's gone from the Midwest and into Colorado and then also into the Southeast. We're all waiting to see whether it spreads further.
Will the flu vaccine, when it starts to be administered, have any impact on this? Does it have any relationship to this?
No relationship, and we should get our influenza vaccine because we can predict with certainty that influenza will come upon us this winter. The recommendation is that all of us should be protected against influenza. If we're older than 6 months of age, we should all get vaccinated each and every year.
But is there a vaccine for the enterovirus 68?
Not yet, no. It's been such a rare phenomenon that there's not been any seeming need for a vaccine. So we don't have a vaccine. We don't have specific antiviral therapy, but we have excellent supportive care so that when these children are all being admitted to the hospital, they're getting excellent supportive care. You know, their ventilation is being assured. They're getting appropriate fluids, and then they're getting better, going home, being discharged, playing baseball next week.
For parents who may be bracing themselves for the possibility of seeing this, when do you know if this may be what your kid has, and when do you know if you need to go and seek medical attention, not just deal with a cold at home?
Yeah, that's a good question. Two things. First, moms particularly know when their youngsters are sick rather than just having a little cold. That should trigger a call to the doctor. And the other, obviously, is if that child is having any difficulty breathing, immediately contact your healthcare provider.
You know, so maybe we'll get a handle on this. Maybe it will wane, as you say, in October. You must also be watching. We've been talking about Ebola. Do you see help on the way from a vaccine on that front? They've got, hyper-fast tests going on, but is there some magic bullet coming?
Let's not wish for a magic bullet, but let's put confidence in the investigations that are really on the fast track now. We have to make sure that vaccines work and are safe, because the last thing we would want to do is employ a vaccine that doesn't work or actually makes people sick. So we're going through these initial procedures, these phases of vaccine evaluation, absolutely as quickly as possible. The anticipation is we could have something in the field ethically approved by the local people, maybe as early as November. That would be splendid.
Do you see an Ebola threat to this country, Dr. Schaffner?
Not at all. We're obviously subject to people having been in West Africa, coming to the United States, becoming sick, and entering hospitals such as my own. But any hospital of any size, a community hospital, an academic medical center, has infection control policies and procedures and training in place so that we can take care of these patients appropriately and safely. But Ebola will not establish itself in the United States. We're helping out what's happening in Africa. And as you have just been hearing, this has all kinds of ramifications for the entire continent in its economy, let alone what's happening in the most affected countries in West Africa now.
William Schaffner, Dr. William Schaffner, joining us from Nashville, Tennessee, chairman of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. Always grateful when you come on. Thanks very much for being with us today, Dr. Schaffner.
My pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.